We're back in the flesh, everyone. We're back in the flesh on a Chesterfield sofa. Feels so nice, doesn't it?
Feels lovely.
Mark's here, John's here. Great. Callum Watkins is here as well. Where's Callum, he come from?
All right.
Look, this where's is so good.
He's come from Leeds.
Yes.
Yeah, come over from Leeds.
Oh, mate, we appreciate that. Isn't it good to be back in the flesh amongst people? You can touch people. We've all been tested.
Well, Callum's just been training, so, you know, over the last probably 6 months. So he's been around people, Will. Yeah. It's just you who's been locked in a flat in London.
Is it just you? I've missed this. This contact, this closeness.
Socially distanced,
yeah,
of course.
Socially distanced. How are you, Callum? You good?
Yeah, really good. Thanks, mate. Yeah, yeah, good.
Look, we always like to get stuck into people's stories. And I know you know these two clowns from a different... You were at Toronto, but for about half a second with John, weren't you?
Yeah,
it doesn't count.
It doesn't count.
Did you get a training kit? Was it?
We didn't even see each other. Toronto players. There was no.
Just webcam Zoom calls.
Zoom calls. Yeah.
About wages and getting paid.
Yeah, when that will never happen.
More importantly, when.
Someone bid on your shirt though. You got shirt number.
Yeah, I did actually. Just the one.
Yeah. What number were you?
That's the only story.
Yeah, I know.
Well, that's your Toronto career.
I don't know what number it was, to be honest.
No, I don't.
It's a question mark.
But when it was all unravelling at Toronto, right? Mm. So Callum Watkins has just signed, sort of big news, and it was all just sort of disintegrating into sort of dust around us. And I think in the last sort of grasp to rescue something, they were auctioning off a Callum Watkins match shirt. The irony was that obviously Callum hadn't even trained, yet alone played for Toronto. Yeah.
But that was to pay the wages, wasn't
it? It got $9.75 from Janet from Dewsbury. Mine got a fiver from Carol Wilkin from Hull.
But look, great to have you here, Callum. Honestly, what when we take you right back to early days in Stretford was the big dream as a kid? Take us back to the childhood.
Yeah. To be honest, we got into rugby league, me and my older brother, through my dad. My dad used to work in Trafford Park, so a lot of guys that he worked with were from Salford and were into rugby. But my dad had a little inkling of rugby in him. He played a little bit when he was a bit younger, so he did go to a lot of the Salford games in the past and wanted to take us to it. And pretty much from there... going to watch Salford at the Willows and all that stuff, and then obviously playing on the weekend and around Salford, it basically just gave us an opportunity to have the dream. Really.
It's gone full circle. It's taken a while to go full circle, isn't it, for you to come back to Salford, to go to Salford in the first place. But talk to us about the Willows, because I remember going there sort of a teenage years, you know, late teenage years. That was some place for people who were listening who were too young to have been there. It was a tasty little venue.
Yeah, very, very tasty. They had the shed where all the home fans were there. They're pretty wild, the Salford fans. So
was that to the right? So as you come out the tunnel, that was the big tall one. Yeah, that's where you get.
Yeah, the big tall one.
Through that. You know, there's like a little cage, isn't there?
Yeah.
Like,
so where you walk out, you walk out onto the field. You're going through a cage basically, and then on the side, on the right hand side, there's Salford fans berating you. And
you must have played there, John.
Yeah, played there. Yeah, it was actually a tough place to go. That just because of that, the changing rooms at the Willows were infamous. You know, like
they're real slope ceiling.
Yeah, and they had like off. You know, a bit like this. There's a Chesterfield in the corner. There's a couple of lads getting changed on like a wing backed armchair with no leather on it. It's like it was all really random. But
all I think psychological, do you reckon?
It's just lack of fun.
Just coincidence.
Yeah.
Usually at away grounds, you get your shirt lined up and where it goes in the order of the positions and everything. But I remember at Salford, you had the smaller guys at one end just because they could fit under the ceiling. So your hookers and your halfbacks in the coach, like Ian Watson, would be down one end, and then taller fellas would be down the other, where it was a bit of a higher.
It was under the terraces of the.
Yeah, right.
You could hear it. You could hear it.
You could hear it outside.
So you used to stand on those terraces, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, I did as a kid. I was a ball boy too. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was in the thick of it, really. Yeah, I went to a lot of the away games as well. So, during the times they were relegated a couple of times, I used to go watch them even when they were down as well.
Is that where you sort of fell in love with the professional game? Do you know, you were playing as a junior, but that sort of being around, being a ball boy, being amongst it, is that where you fell in love?
Definitely, because I met plenty of players in the past. Mm. My favourite player was Jason Robinson at Wigan. So I managed to get his autograph when we played at Salford one time. So that was a big memory for me, remembering like you know, this could be real for me if I can put my mind to it. And
yeah.
During them times, I knew that I had the potential to do it. So
how did you know that? What was the route then from Salford, watching on the terraces, to being at Leeds as a kid?
It was pretty strange, to be honest, because my brother, he was playing at Warrington. He was at the academy.
Cash.
He was at the academy under 18. So I went and watched a game with my dad, and they were playing against Leeds. And previous before that, we were doing like these national camps, and we play like for the Northwest or Lancashire, it was, and we play Yorkshire and then we play Cumbria. So there were scouts there, obviously. And then a few months later, I was watching my brother play. And they played against Leeds, and Leeds beat him by like 40 or something like that. But then I had an opportunity to then do like the water and stuff at Warrington. They just invited me to do it. So I did that and helped out. And basically, I just walked out with my dad and obviously Cash as well. And there was a coach there called John Bastian, who I think is at OKR at the minute, helping with recruitment and everything. And he basically said, look, we know we've watched you play before. We want to see how you go. If you want to come down and look at the facilities and stuff like that. It was like a whirlwind really, which happens. But if I didn't go there, then who knows? I might have been at a different place. I might have been at Warrington, or Salford. I don't know. So yeah, I was pretty lucky in that aspect to see them there at that time.
It does hinge on moments, you know, that time in your early career where, you know, you could go one way or another, you could sign for one club or another, and for whatever reason, you know, those little decisions that you make, or, you know, like going to this, you know, going to Warrington or whatever, you know, they lead to, there's big consequences off the back of it. And I always remember, you know, I played against Lee for Hull KR and had a good game. Ian Millward was the coach of Lee, and then sort of 12 months later, I signed for St Helens. So you neglect, but when you look back, it's good to reflect, isn't it? These little moments that have big consequences, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. You know, if I didn't go to that game just to watch my brother play, then it might have been a totally different story for me.
Or you might have just been really talented and they picked you up anyway.
Yeah. That good kid over there. Yeah. Ask him now.
Do you know what I mean? But even when I went to they got me to visit the stadium, basically, and it was great. And I went to the training ground, and then I went to a game. Basically, Barry McDermott invited me and my dad to the game. I think it was like a last game of the season. I think it was in 2006. So I got to meet the players on the field as well, to shook Kev's hand and everything. And I was like, wow, this is something where I really want to be and play. So
did you think then, when you were meeting those guys, because it was such a phenomenal Leeds team, even when you arrived then, 2006, 2007, you made your debut in 8, didn't you?
Yeah.
But could you see a route into that team, or did it just seem so far off at that stage?
Yeah, it seemed far off, definitely, for me. I just thought, you know, my goal was just to get into the first team. And the year I signed for the academy, I was on trial at first. I was on trial for the first couple of months and got given a game against, I think it was against Warrington actually, in the academy, and played pretty well. So it just went on from there, basically. And then that full year with the academy, we went on to win the 18s grand final. And from there, we had a really good pre-season after that, working with the under 21s at that time. Mm. Played the first 3 or 4 games that year and played really well. And then they signed us up on full time. It was me, Paul McShane, Ben Jones Bishop, Danny Allen as well. So we all pretty much got put in there from there.
I remember you played a World Club Challenge really young, didn't you? You'd kind of only played a few first team games, and then was it Manly at Elland Road? Was that the game?
Yeah. So 08 was the first time I played the first team, and I only played 3 games that year. And Through injury, really, I got that opportunity against Manly. We had a few injuries in the centres and then on the wing as well. So that first time was like, I shouldn't have even been there. You know what I mean? I was on the bench, so I wasn't even expected to get on. But then I remember Rob, he got knocked out by Anthony Watmo, if you could remember that.
Yeah.
And then they had to switch a couple of players around. So I ended up coming on just before half time. So I was like, I couldn't believe it. Like, you know, playing in the World Cup Challenge, I was 17, you know, I was 17 at the time. So it was just a massive experience for me at that time.
The interesting thing about you know, what you're saying there, Cal, about, you know, when you got to Leeds, your goal was to get into the first team. You know, I think for young people or in any career, those incremental goals, you know, like you set a goal to get into the first team, then your next goal is to play regular in the first team, and then it becomes right to just get a squad number, and then you just, right, I want to play for England. But the importance of incremental sort of achievable goals, you know, when I see young players come in and they say, right, you know, that's it, I want to play for my country or whatever, it's almost too lofty, isn't it? You know, those incremental achievable goals, are just massive. So, and it's funny, isn't it? A lot of careers follow that pattern. You're hungry just to replace a certain player who's in your position, maybe, or get into a team, and then it just grows from there. But I imagine the more you got into it, your aspirations grew, you know?
Yeah. Always. I've always had small little steps, especially early on, because obviously moving to Leeds then by myself, I had to move straight after school, basically, and basically leave my parents and everything. So pretty much had to grow up pretty quickly from that, on top of obviously trying to get into the first team. So everything went really quick, a lot quicker than I expected anyway. You know, after a full first year of academy, I was in the first team, and it worked from there. But then I had so many great players that I played with and learned from straight away, you know. So that helped me, I think, achieve my goals even more.
For sure. I think you said you were a hyper kid when you were young. How different did you feel to the other guys trying to make it at that stage?
I just wanted to win all the time. You know, when I was at a team around Salford early on, we hardly won any games, and I was the one that was crying. I was the one that cared that much about losing and everything. So,
where does that come from, though, do you think? Because, you know, you talked about your brother. Is that where it's
from? We're just competitive in whatever we do, really. I think for me, it's just about always about showing the right attitude and working hard. I think it gets you to great places if you put your mind to it. And you get a lot of players, you know, when you're doing like conditioning and running and pre-season and everything like that, like I'm the one that just thinks, right, this is what we need to do. We've just got to get on with it, you know. When things are bad, you just got to get on with it. That's how my mind works, really. When things do get tough, I just think, look, there's better things that can come across. As long as I work hard, put my head down, things will come good. So
there's a common theme there, isn't it, with all the top athletes, especially in rugby, is that competitive edge. I think, like Callum alluded to, it's knowing that in pre-season it's really hard, or in games it gets really hard, but they're willing to go through that because winning is that important to them. And that's the common thing with every professional athlete, and especially rugby league player I've ever spoke to, is they're so competitive. They just want to win at everything, because that's what it boils down to day to day, is that effort to be the best day in, day out.
Mm. It's resilience, that, isn't it, as well? Yeah. You build resilience through doing it. Like, you're never going to win all the time, but, you know, you try, and then you keep trying, and then you become a bit more resilient, and then you keep trying. And it's actually, do you know, the biggest thing in sport is just following through with something. You know, there's a lot of people who try and fail, and then go, right, that's me. But ultimately, if you're going to commit to a career in sport or a career in anything, it is inevitably a succession of failures, you know, with successes in between. And the people who hang around longest, and the reason, you know, Callum has been at the top of his game, and look, there's been tough points in that, but the reason he's been at the top of his game and maintains that position at the top of his game is the resilience to overcome that failure. Because we all fail at some stage, some earlier, some later, some in the middle. But as a young sort of athlete, you have to get your head around failure quick, real quick. Otherwise, you'll end up in a fucking shit state, because sport will kick you down the
road. Sport doesn't care. Nah. It doesn't care if you're a nice guy or you tried your best. Nah. Don't give a shit.
Well, people don't care either, really.
Don't. Life doesn't care.
You know, it's about you, personal responsibility. I'm willing to get hurt doing this, not physically, I'm talking mentally, physically, emotionally, all of it. Get hurt doing this because of failure. And then you've got to be resilient enough to get on and go again.
Did you feel accepted, though? Because I remember Wilco's told this story loads of times. When he left Hull KR, left the pigsty, and went over to St. Helens.
Was he a pig farmer?
Yeah. Did you not talk about that during your 17th season in Toronto?
That's how he introduced himself. He goes, "Hi, John Wilkin. I grew up in a pig farm in Hull."
You can, my pig farming days in Hull.
You've told that story when you got to Saints. People essentially, I can't remember who it was, but said to you, like, "Nah, mate, this isn't for you." you know.
You're just the coach. Yeah. But it's, that's not a good sign, is it? It's the guy who signed me. He said, nah, mate, this is probably not going to work out. Yeah, no.
Was that reverse psychology or did he genuinely believe that?
No, I think he genuinely believed it. No, I honestly think he believed it, Will. And he really wanted me to leave. And I actually stuck there. Yeah, right? No. I was like, you know, the shit that won't flush.
Yeah.
You know, when you're looking down the toilet, you're like, this bastard's going nowhere. That was me. I think that could define my career.
That's how Derek Beaumont described you, actually, the other week. Shit that won't flush.
Did he?
He's coming on the podcast soon, though, Derek. It'll be good to have him on. Yeah.
Well, we'll tell him we'll go on Judge Rinder.
But no, Callum, did you feel, you know, because you go into that Leeds team and you're just around training, just around the place, just around the corridors, heading lead, around the training ground. You've got your Sinfields and your Peacocks and your Burrows. Did they embrace you straight away? Did everyone take you on board?
Yeah, definitely. Especially them guys. I think for me, they're just great people. You know, that was the main thing for me. The playing side, they knew what they were doing. They're so experienced. They won everything in the game. So for me, I was just in awe of these players right from the start. I was just in awe of them. And I wanted to work as hard as I could to earn their respect, really. And when I did get the opportunity, I tried to make it the most that I could. And yeah, we got in positions where I was in at a time where they were winning, you know, pretty much every year. So the expectation on top of that was high.
But you had to earn their respect, didn't you?
Yeah. It took time. That took a lot of time and just playing and getting appearances on the board, really. And basically performing and being consistent was something as well.
But those guys would respect effort, wouldn't they, through the week? You know, a weekend, right, for sure, they would respect you for playing well. Mm. It's a lot of the respect you gain through the week, Cal, isn't it? You know, how you apply yourself through the week.
Yeah, it's all about setting the right example, basically, and showing the right attitude towards them players and helping them out, basically. Because I used to help Keith Senior out a lot with his extras. And, you know, we would play against Matt Gidley against St. Helens and stuff like that. I'll try and help him and try to do the skip out and just stuff like that to try and help them. Like, I wouldn't, like, just brush it aside and say no, you know. I'd want to help my teammates, however young I was. Like, if he wanted me to help, then I'd always be keen to do that. So that's an example.
Did you skin him a few times, Keith?
No.
You've got to say that. You're on air, right?
I remember he was twice the size of me when I first started. So, but I used to have to wrestle him in the wrestle room. Yeah, I used to partner up with him.
The wrestle room? Tell us about the wrestle room.
Well, it's just a big combat room, basically.
In Keith's cellar.
So basically, it's like, it's obviously a room, but it's just covered in pads.
Yeah.
And pads and stuff like that. So you do like your little, your wrestling. And
has every club got a wrestle room?
Well, most, yeah. I'd say most have now. Yeah.
Look at Will's face.
I mean,
he's been working in rugby league for 5 years.
It's not like WWE, it's not like The Rock and Stone Cold Steve Austin. It's right. Like proper, like, Greco-Roman wrestling.
So it's just one-on-one, you know.
What do you mean? Why is one-on-one important?
He thinks it's like a belt on this
brutal
one at the end.
Why are you interested whether one-on-one's important?
Is it like just Brian McDermott looking through like a sort of Call of Duty, a line of duty screen, you know, one-way screen, just watching this, like, yeah, that's Senior and...
I don't know why you've made this really sexual. I don't know why you've done that.
It's just one on one behind a double sided mirror.
Naked with oil.
Pricked up. I've never heard of the wrestle room.
It will get you in the wrestle room.
Right. This still goes on, is it?
Oh, yeah, do you mean so. It still goes on? It's actively part of training.
Well, what do you get out of the I get it, in, as in like, yeah. You know, taking it onto
have
a pitch.
Have you watched a game of rugby league?
Do you have 6-on-6 wrestles?
What do you, have you watched?
Six on six.
Have you watched a game of rugby league?
Yes.
Will?
Saying,
what do you mean? Yes.
Go on. Explain to me what.
Well, have you seen a tackle?
Yeah.
So when have you ever seen a 6-on-6 tackle?
I know, but you're saying you just had a, so it's just a one-on-one.
It's
wrestle
not
room.
Like the Royal no, Rumble, no, Will. No, Will, it's not like the Royal Rumble.
He's thinking everyone comes in with entrance music.
It's not always obviously one-on-one. If you're doing like wrestles type stuff, you might have a partner to work with, but then it might be then. In a normal game scenario, you might have to run into three players or two players.
But this one's in a padded cell, basically. Yeah.
But it's not 6-on-6.
It's never 6-on-6. No. Unfortunately,
there's no steel chairs or anything like that. It's like proper wrestling.
No. So look, go on. Through your time at Leeds, you won everything, didn't you? Pretty much everything that was available. Which is, I mean, you're smiling and we're glossing over that, but that is the stuff of dreams because so many people just go through their whole career and get nowhere near that, near it. So the boy that was stood on the terraces at the Willows very quickly had taken over the world, it won everything that there was. Was there, firstly, how was that? And then was there a side of when you'd completed rugby league, a sort of a feeling of emptiness because you'd done absolutely everything at quite a young age?
I think, especially after the 2015 season, when we had a real good year in terms of the trophies that we won. Obviously, the people that were leaving as well that year with JP, Kevin, Kyler, they moved on that year. Mm. I had a sense then I thought this was, you know, we won quite a lot here. I was in the squad during them times, like 07, 08, 09 and all that stuff, but wasn't playing. So I had an impact in 09 in terms of playing through the season, but not in terms of the back end of it all. So for me, it was incredible. It was just an incredible ride, really, because every year was different. Every year was a journey. And you do go through that, you know, adversity. You know, that's part of sport. That's part of life, really. But you go through it and then you reflect on it all. You self-reflect on it all at the end of the year and just think, wow, look where we were, like mid-season. Because I think most of the time when we did win, we'd start well, then we'd be really bad in mid-season. And then it came to the end, we just knew.
Bloody Leeds.
Yeah.
They always beat Saints in the final.
Yeah, so but it was like that for majority of the time. I think the only time that was near enough consistent was 2015, where pretty much all year we was great. But after the Challenge Cup, we lost three on the trot. So we thought, oh, you know, maybe it's coming back to bite us here. But
what's that down to, Leeds? What is that? Because that is a microcosm of Leeds over the last 20 years, isn't it?
What's that?
That inconsistency of being absolutely fantastic to.
I worked with Brian McDermott in Toronto, and it really opened my eyes to something that, you know, when you meet somebody and you speak with them, and then I started to understand why Leeds beat us in big games. You know, and I think Brian, for whatever criticisms or compliments there are about his coaching, managed the emotional sort of the narrative of the season, the why, like why are we doing this, and could get hold of a story about why you were going to be great for a week or, you know, for a period. And that's why I think at the big games at the back end, that Brian's understanding of the emotional sort of development to get towards a big game, it blew my mind, because it was something we'd never done at Saints. We just got played, we maybe got to the grand final and we were like, right, we'll go play the grand final. There wasn't a why, you know, we had this really stubbornly held belief that we were just the best team or something, you know what I mean? And it was really naive, it was mega naive, you know, looking back.
Did you not have that at Leeds, that feeling?
We always had that, like John said, we always had that why, we always had that talk, especially before the season. Brian would always have a plan ahead and we would always speak. We'd always speak and have a plan ahead of what we wanted to achieve that year. And it would change during the season as well, depending on how we were going. Mm. We're coming up to the big games at the back of the year, back end of the year. There'll be something will come up and we'll have a meeting or we'll talk about this is what we're going to aim for. Why? Yeah. Why is this going to happen? How is it going to happen? You know, certain things like that. So, yeah, he was great in terms of that. He was great in terms of motivating certain players at times as well.
You can never rest just on that, what Wilco was saying. You can never rest just on the feeling that, oh, we're the best team and we win games.
It's like a mad sort of mentality, really. And, you know, I look back at those games where Leeds and Callum's team beat us in big games and look back at it with just a bit of, like, shame about how we prepared at times. Don't think we prepared thoroughly enough. It was like, you know, again, like working with Brian McDermott, I begin to understand like the momentum and building of momentum and like building to something, whereas I don't know if we ever really did that.
Well, there's something to be said for like looking at the bigger picture during the season, because if you're playing every cup game and the playoffs, it's 30-35 games in a season, and to be mentally at your best every week, that's some toll. That I don't know many players that can be at the peak every week. So there's probably something to be said for kind of breaking the season down and thinking, right, that's going to be a big period where we're going to be at our best, and maybe putting extra motivation in prior to that so that lads are kind of hitting the straps at that point and then having to dial in back for a little bit and then kind of just working out when your team got to be the best. Because for the regular season, as long as you're in the top 2, 3, 4, you don't probably need to be at your best every week, especially for a club like Leeds with the calibre of players.
No, and that's what the playoffs have really, you know, it's been around for a long time now, but the playoffs really change like how things are done, right?
Because, yeah, definitely.
You know, it's not like a race to the finish line. You can, you know, if you're best, you know, I think since we won the League Leaders Shield like 6 or 7 times in that period, but we came away with nothing, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the playoffs really changed that, as in managing momentum. You know, you didn't have to go full tilt for a full year. You can dampen it down. Whether you look, sometimes on purpose, you know, when you're in that mid-season bit of a slump, it don't feel great, does it? You know what I mean? It's not always on purpose, but sometimes that can just give you the kick up the arse, what
and
you
big
need.
Big clubs can do it. Like when I was at Salford for a long time, we were struggling lower to mid-table. And we had to give every single game our best because we knew there probably wasn't always going to be a playoff, so we probably wouldn't get a good cup run. So there's probably 6-7 games where we wouldn't have to be at that at our best, but every 2 points we had to just fight for. But a team like Leeds with the squad they'd have some squad rotation, would have players who could be 6-7 out of 10 and they'd still be better than most players. Jamie Peacock could still be better than most front rowers in the comp. So they could afford to be probably subpar and still get the results, but I think other clubs probably couldn't get away with that as well.
Was the expectancy to be at that ultimate level exhausting?
Yeah, definitely. I think it made a big impact on the team. Like you said, you won the League Leaders so many times. I think during my time at Leeds, we only won it twice. So the other times that we did win the grand final, we were coming from fifth. I think the last time we were in 2017, we were second. So. And we were consistent. That's how we finished second. We weren't great, but we were consistent. Plus, there was pressure off us from 2016 as well, which it didn't go too well. It took a lot of pressure from us, and you know, I think it was a big gear for Cass. And we ended up we lost to them about 4 or 5 times through the season, pretty easy as well. So we went into that final thinking, you know, we're gonna have to come up with our best performance of the year to win that game. And you know, we did.
Was Brian McDermott the coach, would you say, looking, and you're only 30 now, there's still a long way to go, but in your career so far, the one coach that could really get inside your head?
Yeah.
More than anyone?
Yeah, definitely. I think at first, I think we struggled in terms of communication. I was, to me, I'm pretty quiet at times. Well, probably a lot more back then. I was pretty quiet. I just got on with my thing, really, and didn't open up enough. So he was trying to get me to open up a little bit more.
How did you do that?
Basically,
go on, Callum, open
he
up.
Got me. He got me to see a sports psychologist. Actually,
did he?
Yeah. So, it was a woman that I it was at college, and she was one of my tutors. But she was doing sports psychology as well. Mm. So she got me. He got me to speak to her for a little bit. So it was comfortable because she was my tutor a couple of years back. So I was able to open up a little bit.
You trusted
to her.
And you knew
yeah,
her.
I trusted her. Yeah. So basically, it was just trying to get me to open up a lot more, and I was just more comfortable with Brian, really. He let me do my thing.
Why were you closed off in the first place?
I think that was just me as a person anyway during that time. So for me, I was just, a lot of the time, I just wanted to work hard for my team. I wanted to win. I just wanted to, I guess a little bit was still about gaining more respect, really. Mm. Just because of the players that I was playing with, I was still at that time in awe of these players.
That's your character, though. Something that I noticed when Callum came into the dressing room at Salford last October, was it August time?
Yeah, August time.
He was probably one of the best centres in the world and had been for the previous 10 years. And he was the quietest guy in the change rooms. I know he was a new signing, but to say all you'd done in the game, I could see that it was natural for you to be quite a humble fella, pretty quiet, just got along with his job. And obviously we've had good chats and had a beer together and enjoyed each other's company. But I just think that's probably your character as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I think people thought it was strange when I got the captaincy at Leeds. But I think it was the help from Brian that helped me get to that point. I'd become a lot more of a leader then. And I'd say a lot more things. But for me, I'd always say something which would be important for my team and supportive to my team. I wouldn't just say something for the sake of it, you know. So that was my type of character. But I think a lot of people were shocked that I got the captaincy. I was shocked as well. I was shocked. I thought, you know, Steve Award was the clear, obvious guy that would come in and do that, because he just had that leadership quality about him, how he played the game as well. He was a captain, yeah, definitely. So for me, when that happened, it was a big, that was a massive thing for me. It's probably one of my proudest moments, really. Yeah, to become captain, really, without even expecting it, you know.
It's interesting when you're in a squad, like everybody's different, and you know, Callum walking into the Leeds dressing room, you've got Kevin Sinfield, Jamie Peacock, Rob Burrow, Danny Maguire, you know, all these types of characters. Like, you're the necessity for you to actually talk, you know, like to actually be vocal as a younger, you know, player is probably not that, you know, that's not your role, is it?
No.
You've got enough guys who can roll out a Churchillian match day speech, you know, to get everybody going.
Yeah.
So you just don't need, you know, I feel like, you know, you don't need to do that.
Mm. Yeah, that I felt that way
and
as well.
That's quite a difficult thing because then, you know, when those guys move on and that, you need people to take that on.
Yeah.
And there's a skill in actually just developing your leaders underneath you. And I think Brian McDermott maybe developed you as that leader, but it can be really... the reason I'm saying this is when I signed for Saints, you walk in, there's like Kieran Cunningham, Sean Long, Paul Wellens, Paul Sculthorpe, and they do all the talking for the team. I could turn up to train and not say anything.
Mm.
But when that changed, that's when I learned more about myself, where I had to talk.
And that was and a big... 2016 was a big moment for Leeds because all those players, those leaders moved on. I know there was still Danny Maggs and Rob Burrow, but JP and Cine and Kylie were like the main guys, weren't they, in terms of like driving standards, leading the club. And with you guys underneath, I think it's probably quite an important time for the club to kind of move on to the next level. And it probably took a couple of years. Well, you had success in 17, but 16 and 18 were subpar seasons for Leeds, weren't they?
Yeah, definitely. I think, again, from the 17 season, obviously Danny and then Rob went as well. Yeah. So they were an integral part to that leadership group as well. But yeah, it was always going to be difficult. They're pretty irreplaceable, really, them players for what they brought to the game and what they brought to the club as well. I remember JP, he reminds me every single week where he'd say something and he'd say something that he's going to do in the game and he'll just go out and do it, you know. Like, that was a prime example of him. He would talk the talk and back it up, you know what I mean? And then Kylie was quiet, he didn't really talk that much, but how he proved his way through actions and stuff like that. So
when Brian McDermott then coaxed you out of your shell, did you improve as a player? Did you see that just as a natural transition to benefit you on the pitch as a player when you were more willing to be able to talk and to be comfortable in front of people?
Yeah. I think during that 15 season, he tried to get me to talk a little bit more, you know, before games and stuff like that, even just having a little chit chat with the outside backs and stuff like that, or our edge or something like that. And it did improve me as a player because I think that year was probably one of my best years. So,
I think because we've had him on the podcast, haven't we? Brian McDermott, it was brilliant. He was absolutely brilliant. But, you know, he's had his demons in the past. I'm sure he's told you all about them.
Yeah.
And, you know,
he's got his demons now.
He's still.
Yeah,
he's still got his demons.
We all certainly have. But he to me seems the perfect person to change you as a man, as a human, because of what he's been through, and because you know he's made such a transition in his life.
Yeah.
That you're comfortable then talking about those things in front of someone like that who's done it, rather than, you know, someone you don't know anything about their history.
Yeah, I think what he's been through through his life, it's been very, very, fairly tough. So for him, it was at the start, it was getting him towards the players that wanted the best. He wanted to get the best out of. I remember Brad Singleton; he'd really get at him, you know, early on, just trying to fit him into the forwards and everything, because he was playing most weeks. I remember he sent him out on loan as well. He went to Wakefield as well, and he came back. He just came back a better player, Brad. And I think it was through what Mac was saying to him. He was getting into him every single week. He'd have a good game, but there'll be always something. There'll be always something that Brian will get at to make sure that he's always on focus with his game.
It's like a military approach, isn't it?
A bit, a bit. He's got ways that... You know, players might not agree with, but
you can't disagree with sending someone out on loan to get a response, though. Because what's he doing there, right? So he sends a player as a coach, right? You send a player out on loan. Why? To give them some negativity, to stimulate a response. Like, the good players go out on loan, come back. Paul McShane bounced around. You know, look what happened. You know what I mean? He's come great. You know, sending someone on loan is a test. You know,
you get the answer you need, don't you? If you come back a better player, he's worth keeping. If they, you know, sulk, throw the toys out the pram, don't improve, then you realise that that kind of player is not good enough for that club.
Yeah, and that's I think that's just smart coaching. But it's that was an it was just an interesting time for Leeds. You know that, you know, not good, win it, not good, win it type. Yeah. That routine.
That's you know, that's why I think the 17 season was, I think not a lot of people think it was really that great, but I look at it as one of the best wins really because of what we came through from 16 and building more players and leaders through that, including myself. So that year we went and won it. No pressure was on us, yeah, from the year before, but we went on to win it and not expected to. And that was the, we didn't even celebrate like we did the 15 season. We were just jumping all over each other. Like the 17 season, we just stood there and we were just like, wow, you know, we've done this. Like we've come from where we've come from. We nearly got relegated, and then coming back to it and win it. I think, you know, it bodes well for what Brian did for the club. If you look back at what Brian did for the Leeds club, it was incredible, really.
It's resilience, isn't it, that we said before, that bouncing back from adversity, which was 16, and it's probably the lessons that were taught and the culture that was set by those leaders that preceded that 17 season that kind of was ingrained in the squad, and that's what probably pushed you on to that success in 17.
Absolutely. And you were arguably, you know, one of the best centres in the world at this stage when you're lifting all of these trophies. When you look back and you're in the nursing home and you're old and you're grey and we're all there rocking back and forward and we're past the jigsaw, Wilkin.
5 years.
Yeah.
10 years. This could easily be a scene.
This is a seamless transition into the nursing home where we are now. But what will you look back on with the fondest memories? What's the one that was really special to you? Was it as obvious as to say a World Club challenge, or you know, what is it that day that you remember? Like, wow, this is one that I'm going to remember forever.
We've had a few days like that, but I think obviously the 15 and 17 seasons were a big moment, but also just getting into the first team and playing my first game, I think that was a big moment for me, also my family as well. I always look back at that and thinking, you know, wow, I've got an opportunity to play in Super League. Like I've been dreaming as that since I was 5 years old to do that. And that was my, really around that time, that was my ultimate goal, just to play in Super League and then build up from there. So plenty of memories. I couldn't put my finger on one really, but.
And look, it's not all been plain sailing, isn't it? It's not all been, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Lolly, la, 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 la. No, forgotten it.
Butterflies and rainbows.
Butterflies and what?
Rainbows.
I love butterflies.
It's not all been butterflies and rainbows, is it?
Yeah.
Look, leaving in 2019, how difficult was that? How awkward was that?
Because awkward.
Well, just like, was it awkward?
Callum's
words
left.
In your mouth? Was it awkward?
it was the way
that you left?
Yeah, it was pretty strange, to be honest. For me, I wasn't in a good place regardless during that time. So through 18, I did my ACL, and then trying to come back from that. The rehab stuff was all right, but I thought I could deal with it better because I'd done it previous. I did it 10 years ago previous, and as a young kid, you just go through it. You just go through the rehab and all that stuff. But when you're older, you look back a little bit and think, oh, this is a tough injury you got to get back to.
You were only 26, 27? You weren't?
27, 28, yeah. And then I came back, and I came back too early. Definitely came back too early. I think I was like 7 months into the rehab, really, and should have just give it a little bit more time. There's the pressures of obviously being captain. There's pressures of, I had a testimonial that year as well. And
that's some pressure, that, isn't it?
Yeah, I had everything like involved, obviously getting back from injury, sorting out all this testimonial stuff. And then obviously being a captain as well, I had to lead there. And then obviously at home, it wasn't going too great as well with my marriage. So on top of all that, it wasn't the ideal time to go back in and to play, but I thought during that time I needed to play because I felt I was getting away from other things as well, which probably wasn't the best idea in terms of that. It didn't help my game anyway.
What did that feel like, Callum? You know, you talk about all those things. You know, what did that feel like to you when you had all those things going on?
You know what? I had when I got back from Australia and obviously lockdown happened, it's made me reflect a lot of it really. And it was tough. It was. It's probably been the toughest two, three years of my life, really. Yeah. And reflecting back at it, you go through certain things, and I have done through the years, like with my mental health and everything. But at that time, it was bad. Like it was worse than it could ever be. So for me, I think being able to come out the other side of that and accept, being able to accept that, that this stuff happens and got to be able to be resilient in certain moments. And obviously with rugby, it's been tough. Like, I didn't, when I did leave Leeds, it wasn't the best time for me, but in a way, a better time for me to just get away from everything. And then go to Australia, the Gold Coast was incredible. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And it got cut short with COVID and everything. And my dad ended up getting COVID, and the stuff was going on behind the scenes as well with my ex-partner and her family as well. So it was best for us to come back and settle back in the UK, because Australia wasn't going to be forever. So the Gold Coast was a magnificent experience. It was something that I'll never regret doing.
Did you think you'd be in the NRL longer?
Yeah, I wanted to. I really enjoyed a real tough pre-season. Justin Holbrook just came in to coach as well, and we got on really well, and probably got the best out of me through the pre-season as well, getting ready for a big year, because it was obviously a big job for him as well, coming back to the NRL, and wanted to do well there, and can see now how he's doing. So he's doing a fantastic job there with the players there. So yeah, I wanted to carry on. I wanted to carry on playing. And I think after that, when COVID hit, I had another year left as well. So things were going pretty good, rosy, and everything like that. No COVID or anything. I'd probably still be there now. So things happen though, don't they?
I think in, you know, listening to Callum there, there's pressure in everything in life. You know, like, most jobs have pressure. But I think there's periods in your life where there's pressure, like, domestically, pressure work-wise, there's pressure, you know, with your mentality, there's pressure with, you know, external events, testimonials and all that.
Yeah.
And I think you can deal with a couple. Do you know, you can get away with a couple. Rugby's not going so great. Maybe, you know, something else ain't quite right. But when there's, like, maybe more than two or three sources of pressure come at you, It's a mad time, you know. And I remember I think we'd played Leeds actually at Langtree Park, and I was in a similar position. I was captain, team weren't going great, you know. There was loads of stuff going on at the time, and I was just, you know, I sat down in the change rooms after a game, and I think I just stayed in the change rooms for an hour after the game on my own, you know.
Yeah.
And it was that point at which I reckon there was four or five bits of pressure that I was feeling and dealing with. You know, you just keep them at arm's length, don't you? And then all of a sudden it just went full. Boom, on top of me, and I was like, fucking hell. You know, the external pressure, criticism of fans, right, that's, look, it happens, doesn't it? You know,
it still hurts though, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, but domestically, you know, things not going great, and then you've got, I found I was fine when it was one thing, but when it became three or four, that's when
Because if it's one thing, you can turn in a different direction, and you've got your family, or if your family's not going great, you can go to rugby. But it's when everywhere you turn, there's that negativity and that stress, that's where you don't get any respite.
Yeah,
and that's what I've found speaking to obviously you and then other mates who've kind of had similar kind of.
And I think the temptation is when you're under that much pressure, and you know, I see this part, I saw it in you, do you know what I mean? I could see it,
yeah.
Do you know, because I'd been there, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I remember, you know, watching and you know, I felt for you, not as in sympathy, fucking hell, you know what I mean? We're grown men, you know what I mean? But I saw it and I could understand it. And I think that it's one of the things we neglect, you know. And when you're under that much pressure, do you know what you do? And I don't know if you did this, but when I was like that, I made it all about me. You know, I was like, I put it all on myself. You know what I mean? You make it all about you.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting thing. It all becomes then internal about yourself. When, look, the world just keeps spinning, doesn't it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Every day is like different.
It's hard to see it like that, though, isn't it?
It is, but it's the only way.
When you're in the moment.
It's the only way to see it, because the reality of it, any of us achieving anything that makes the history books in 1,000 years' time, are they going to remember, you know?
I'd like to think they'll remember this podcast.
Can you imagine?
They'll remember you.
Yeah, this could be like the start. This could be the new Testament.
The newest Testament.
The brand new Testament.
But look, you have had, for those who don't know, Callum, who are listening, you have had your struggles with depression as well. So it's a good time to bring that into the conversation. When were you sort of officially diagnosed with depression? And I'm thinking back to the sort of 2015 season when everything was going so right on the field and things were going tits up off the field. And then you started to, like Wilco was saying there, I guess when it's coming from all angles and it becomes so overwhelming, you try and suppress it, you try and disguise it all, and that's probably the worst thing you can do, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think during that 15 season, it was around that time I did get diagnosed with it. But it was probably, like I said, the one thing. That was just the one thing where I could then go to rugby and
forget about it,
basically.
Medication.
Yeah, basically. Well, I what I did was during the weeks we were playing, I'd go and see a counsellor on a Wednesday. Mm. And most of the time we play on a Friday. So after I did my counselling session, I was sweet. I was like, right, I've got a game on Friday. Like, I'm ready. Like, then I think I get the best out of myself when I'm playing. So
can I just rewind a little bit before that? So when was the point where you thought, or someone told you, or whether it was McDermott or whatever, or someone in your life went, you need to see someone, or did you make that decision? And how, you know, because that's not an easy thing to diagnose.
No, I think it took me a long time. I think I knew I had something up for a couple of years before that. And then it got to a point where my ex now, she didn't want to be with me no more. Mm. So she wanted to leave. But then I spoke to my mum quite a lot during that time, because me and my mum had a pretty strange relationship growing up. Mm. And we wasn't as close as we wanted to be. But during that time where I was struggling, she was there and she helped me out massively. Basically forced me to the doctors, basically, and said, look, you need to do it. I've been through it before and I've gone and got the help. So yeah, from there, we went on from there, and obviously spoke to the club about it and stuff like that. And they were massively supportive of everything, and just helped me get them counselling sessions ahead. But I knew that there was still some more underlining things that were going on with me. So,
were you on antidepressants?
Not at that time, but I am now at this moment in time. Yeah. So yeah, and I've been for a while.
What are they like? Because I mean, well, I know what they're like. It's like amphetamines, isn't it? But that is rocky.
How do you know?
Well, I just know people who are on them. You know, it's yeah. like taking speed, you know, essentially, isn't it? It's kind of. But how do you balance yourself out when you have such incredible highs after? You know, I know the medication is supposed to keep it flat line.
Yeah, it keeps it. It does. It, to be fair, it's kept me flat line for quite a while. I do have a time where I do hit a low, real bad as well. Mm. But I think with me, it was always about accepting it, accepting that there was a problem. And I think I had a real bad problem dealing with that. Mm. It took me such a long time to really, probably the end of last year, early this year, has made me realise and accept the situation that obviously I'm in now.
And is that the biggest barrier, the acceptance?
Yeah, absolutely. Because there's loads of things that go on. Like I've seen sports psychologists before, and they always talk about the situations that you've been through, but then you've got to be willing to get past that barrier of accepting it. And then you can then move on from it and then move on to the next part of your life. And that's always been the struggle for me, about accepting the fact that there's going to be times, this is an illness, this is something that you can manage, you can control, it's always going to be there. But if you can accept it in yourself and think, look, this is what I've got, I know how to manage this, and I can move on with my life. And when it does hit down, a downer, I know how to deal with it, so I'm a better person to my kids and all that stuff, and not being able to just be in a slump and just let it dwell. Yeah, because that's what I was like.
It's a slump. Yeah, draw the curtains. Yeah, and let everything go on.
Go on, share us with what those the dark moments are.
I just wasn't proactive enough early on. I just didn't want to do anything. I just didn't have the energy. When I was at home, I just didn't have the energy to do anything, you know. So I would look after my eldest son now. Like, I'd struggle to even take him out, you know what I mean? Like, I just had no energy to be proactive at all. And that made it difficult. And even, like, going out to places, I couldn't even, like, I struggled with, like, anxiety as well. Like, I couldn't even pick up a phone to pay a bill or anything. I was just that anxious about a reaction of someone. Or
was that
how
anxiousness
I was gonna...
all the time, or was that just during these periods?
I think during these periods, yeah. A lot early on, though. A lot of the time early on as well. I just think with the rugby situation as well, I just thought, I'm just in complete awe of these players, and I don't want to let these guys down, you know. And there was the pressures of that, expecting to win, expecting to perform every week. And probably during them years, I wasn't consistent, but at times I was really good. Like, And then it came to the 15 season where I was consistent. It's just so strange how life works, how you could be so consistent playing. But then off the field, you don't even want to get out of bed, you know?
And do you think you had this condition all your life? Is it something that you thought was brought on by your rugby career, or did your rugby career, you know, influence your periods of sort of depression?
Looking back, I think I did have it for such a long time, for a very long time, probably through my teenage years, I reckon. Like, I've got a real small group of friends, and I've always had them small group of friends since high school. And for me, I've always been pretty quiet, pretty introverted with what I do, and like my own company most of the time. So, yeah, and that's always been like that for me. But then I've also then, obviously, with rugby and stuff like that, had the pressures of making it and trying to be somebody, really. But I always look back in terms of the rugby and think that didn't really make an impact for me with my mental health until the 19 season, where I did leave Leeds. Like, I wasn't playing well, came back from injury too early, and I was at breaking point at that point. Because I'll tell you, I've not really said this before, but when we played a game at home, I think it was against Wakefield. I remember playing against Bill Tupou, and I missed about 7 tackles on him. He just ran over the top of me and everything. I had the worst game like ever, like probably one of my worst games, obviously defensively and everything. So I was gone, like my head was gone after it, like basically. And that weekend, like, I planned my suicide. And I thought, this is it for me. Like, what I was going through for my marriage, like, it was over. It was breaking down. I just felt there was nothing left for me, really. So I got to that point where I was planning, and it was going to be in my own home as well. So, but looking back at that, my kids that weekend really got involved with me. So then it made me realise, like, I can't do that. Like, I looked at myself and thought, I'm never going to be in that situation ever again where I'm going to think about ending my life. Yeah. Them kids there, like, they're not going to be with their dad if I do that, you know? Like, it's something that I've kept hold of for a while. I've not really spoke about it as much to people, but I feel like it's important to do that because I just want to help people at the end of the day. Like, I've done this thing on Instagram. It's just to give a helping hand to certain people. And obviously, I've done some stuff with Stevie Ward. He's been doing a little bit. He did this resilience challenge a couple of weeks ago, which was pretty cool. And just being able to see people and check in with people and seeing how they're feeling, they give like a free word check-in, basically.
And at that time, when you were planning that, and you, like you said, you planned it in your own home, in your head, are you thinking, this is the most selfless thing I can do? Because obviously everyone else around you, and your mum and your family and everyone and your brother, everyone would have had that happened. There would have been a time of looking back and gone, that's the most selfish thing that he could ever have done. But in the scenario, you're thinking, this is the most selfless thing, that I'm just not worthy of anything.
Yeah, yeah, you're totally right on that. And for me, I just didn't think I had anything left to offer. Everything that I was doing was wrong. Like, that's how I felt in my mind. Everything that I was doing was wrong. Yeah, ultimately, like, I have to accept responsibility for certain things that I did in my life and in my marriage as well. So that's part and parcel of it. That's me as a person anyway. I accept if I made a mistake or let people down, like, I'll always do that. But I was so hard on myself. That was probably the issue. I was that hard on myself.
So common, that.
And then on top of that with rugby as well, I'm not playing well. I'm not playing, I'm captain. Like,
Jesus.
I'm expected to perform well. I'm expected to get the best out of my players.
When that's your release, right?
As well.
So that's been your release, right? And shit's going on, and then your release is not working now. Mm. So your medication, right? Yeah. I go to rugby because I just know that's my way out, my escape.
Yeah.
But then if that's not quite clicking, man, that's.
Do you ever wonder what would happen had you not? And do you still think that had you not had the rugby? Because at times it's the pressure, it's the extra pressure that may have caused some of this.
Yeah.
Or heightened some of it. But without it, and you're Callum in Stretford.
Yeah.
Cleaning toilets. You know.
He's got a civil engineering degree.
No, I know. No, yeah. I'm just saying I'm giving you a completely different life, most people just have and are happy with and accept. But had you not had those highs of the rugby, would it have been harder?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. But I always think, like, without rugby, probably a little bit of a lost soul, really. I don't know.
It's hard to define yourself away from
belonging.
Yeah.
Like, give you rugby. Purpose.
It gave me a bit, gave me a purpose. Yeah. It's made me to help me do other things as well, you know what I mean? Yeah. So if rugby wasn't there, then
I
don't know.
It's just a huge topic, this. The reason I asked the question is whether you always felt like this or, you know, rugby can give you purpose, but it can break your spirit as well. Like, sport can do two things to you. It can build your ego up, right? It builds you up and you find purpose and you're proud of what you do. But the moment that stops going so well, it actually has a count. It can go the other way, you know what I mean? Yeah. You feel like you've let everyone down. Everyone's unhappy with you and stuff. So it's a huge topic, but like, it's unbelievable that Cal's like opened up like that. And you know, you'd be astounded how many people feel like that, you know?
Yeah.
You know, as soon as you probably said those words, I imagine there's been a lot of people approached you said, I've been in that situation myself.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to ask a really stupid question, right? And I know it's stupid, but I'm asking from a point of someone who's never, ever considered something like that. How confident then are you when, you know, going forward, and I know it's every day as it comes, even now on medication and whatever, with a condition like that, but that you'll never get to those sorts of lows again with the right people around you and obviously the medication and everything going well away from rugby.
Yeah. To be honest, it's like I say, accepting that situation, but
does it scare you that you could get back to feeling like that again?
No, because I feel like there's been times where I could have gone that way. There has been times over the past few months as well that I could have gone that way. But I feel like I look at myself and think, look, I've promised myself, I've said to myself, I've committed to myself that I ain't going to get into that situation again. So whether it's, if I'm going to feel down, feel down, but being able to manage it, I know how to manage it a lot better, better now. So,
do you know what's mad? That in listening to Cal and that, a lot of that was down to his selflessness, because he's a hero of Leeds. He was captain of the club. He was coming back from a serious injury. And you probably knew at the time that you weren't fully fit, were you? But you wanted to play to help the cause, to help the club, to help your teammates. Quite a selfless act. But on the back of that, as a result, you're playing poorly and you're missing tackles against Bill Tupu, which kind of, it pushes you into probably more into that cycle of depression and anxiety. And I think it's quite important for fans to understand that when a player like Callum might miss a few tackles, there are things going on behind the scenes, and you on the back of it, you might take measures or think about stuff that are as extreme as, you know, what you just said. So I think it's mad that, you know, a selfless act can drive you to that sort of stuff. But I think it's also interesting for and key for fans or people watching on the telly to realise that you've got normal emotions like everybody else, and keyboard warriors might not see what's going on behind the scenes. Yeah. It can be quite serious. But there is a lot going on in someone's head.
Fans need heroes and villains, don't they? You know what I mean? And at one stage, maybe Callum Hughes is the ideal villain for him. You know what I mean? They can pin the blame on something or someone, or, you know, and you see it in sport, don't you? You know, somebody gets laden with loads of pressure and stress and blame, and other people don't. And that's, look, being captain as well, like that, you know, at the time, you know, it's part of the responsibility. You know, and as much as it's tough to deal with the Cal, it comes with that.
Comes with
you're captain. That is on you. You know that you get put in front of the cameras. Like, how many times? I'm interested at this, because there's times when Saints we're not doing so great. I mean, we're still finishing third, fourth, fifth, you know, in the league, but it's not going great. And you get shoved in front of the cameras at the end of the game, and the amount of times,
you usually love that, don't you? Getting put
Until Damian Johnson from the BBC asked me, he said, "You've just broke a record today, John. Saints have never been beaten by as much in a Challenge Cup semi-final."
Castleford. Was that Castleford?
Yeah,
I remember that.
But it's tough, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because what do you do? Like, how do you deal with that? You know what I mean? You're in front of a camera. You don't want to be there.
Yeah.
You don't even know what to say, do you?
No. For me, I just wing it. I just just wing it and try and explain as best as possible for them to know. But it's just hard to do that anyway. You're in that kind of emotion as well. You're just like, this is not what you need right now after just what's just happened. So.
I can't get over what you said there. It's quite stunning what you said, but I find it amazing that you should almost count yourself lucky that you had your kids, because they stopped you doing.
Yeah.
Do you reckon it might have ended differently if you didn't see your kids that weekend?
Possibly. But during that time, I was still living for my ex and the kids anyway, so it did help in that sense that I was still home, you know. But if I was on my own, then.
But you didn't discuss any of this with anyone at the time?
No.
How long did it take you to tell someone about that?
Probably another year or so.
Did it?
So you had that. You kept that for a year?
Yeah, pretty much.
Easy, but when you're in that, so I imagine if you've been depressed and you hit it, you've been an actor for a lot of time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you've been you read about depression and people become unbelievable actors. Like, as in, you know, you can you can strut down the street, you're fine.
Yeah.
But that would easily sit under your disguise, wouldn't it? That sort of stuff.
Absolutely. I probably... During the time, obviously with rugby and everything, it was just so easy to hide that. And I remember in 2016, I remember speaking. Oh, it might have been 17, actually. I was speaking about the depression that I had in 15. I never mentioned it to all the players. And the players, some of the players will come up to me and say, like, I never even thought you'd be in that position, really.
What was it like, though, even the next day, the conversations that you had with yourself? Going into whatever after that game, rehab or whatever, or training 3 days later, 4 days later, the conversations that you had with yourself in the car on the way there, and I mean,
I was still in a bad way then. Like, right, during that week, I remember, because after that game, I took 2 weeks off. Like, I said, look, I need to get my knee right. I need to give it a couple of weeks. I went to get an injection in my knee, and during that week, they were getting me to train and stuff like that. And I couldn't train properly. I was doing a swim with one of the assistants, and I did the first like rep. I couldn't do any more. I just had no energy at all. Then I just went, right, I need to speak to someone. I need to get the help right now. Like, I need to see someone. And look, the Leeds were fantastic with me in terms of that. They helped me out massively. Mm. But on top of that, it was a situation as well. I'm not playing well. I just signed a new deal the year before, which was I was going to be marquee player. So they didn't want to go ahead with that deal, mainly because I wasn't playing well. I wasn't in a good position. So that's what really happened through the Leeds situation, which ultimately, through that year, was really my last year anyway. And I wanted to play in the NRL. That was the plan regardless anyway, because I signed a new deal and it would have been for another 2 years. But then after that, I'd have gone to the NRL. That was my goal anyway. I was going to go to the NRL regardless. So just went a little bit earlier.
Just a little bit earlier. I think it's huge. Will, you just said it then. It's massive, really, to speak about in that such... Like, it's not just that you're saying these things. It's the honesty and how you're saying it is powerful. People will resonate with that. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? People listen to that. I hear people talk about these issues a lot, and I can't get my head around it. I can't see it. Yeah. But with you, I could see it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And that's why I find it powerful, because, you know, I think we can all sit and say, oh, you know, this is how you should deal with things, and, you know, it's really tough, and, you know, this blah, blah, blah. But it's the visual cues, you know, looking back, and could see it in you know what I mean? And the way that you've managed to ride it through, and you're in a good place now, you know, that's the story, isn't it? You know, it's not that you know, you call it bad times. It's the fact that he's rode it out, and he's...
Well, and there's a long way of the journey to go now. You're 30.
Yeah. I mean.
He's been around a long time. He's not 30. There's not a chance he's 30.
He's got over Femi Martin's passport. I think also it's a really strong message. And you mentioned keyboard warriors, and there are so many of them out there. And I guess for some people, it's quite easy to be a keyboard warrior, maybe because they're so unhappy with their own life and self, which, you know, is fitting what we've just been talking about. But I think it's a message that before you pick up your phone and think, you know, I'm going to write this, I'm going to write that to Callum Watkins, who's not been playing the way that he should have been playing, or whoever, or George Burgess, or all these superstars that should be playing the way that they were playing 5-6 years ago.
Yeah.
Maybe just think, do you know what? I'm not going to be a CUNT today. I'm not going to send that message.
Yeah, yeah. Sure, but then what Callum's done, which is fucking genius, is he's used personal responsibility to get himself help.
Yeah.
You got yourself help.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. You know, these people, if you play a sport, people are going to come at you. You know, sitting here on two Chesterfields.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is it's like it could be one message that could have tipped you over the edge that weekend.
For sure, for sure. But Callum, you'd acknowledge there's a problem and you've dealt with it. And
yeah, both good answers.
No, you're right. Look, abuse, online abuse is just... it's just part of like this.
It compounds the issue, doesn't it? It can compound.
Yeah, people are compelled to tell everybody what they think of them. Like, you know, that's just the way the world is now. Mm. You've seen it, you know, whether it be, you know, everyone's opinion on Meghan and Harry, Derek Beaumont on me. You know, there's just people out
what's
there.
What's Derek's opinion on you?
Yeah, I don't know this.
No, just give it a Google.
He obviously doesn't Google. Yeah. He's been reading up on it.
Listen, mate, I really appreciate you coming in. And, I mean, I don't think any of us were expecting that. But, I mean, it's so good to see you, one, in a really good place now. And, you know, and it's, you're not always going to be in a good place. You know that. So the fact that you can manage that and control that is amazing, because that's the biggest gift that you've got, being able to manage that going forward, because it's not just going to disappear. So I appreciate your honesty, mate. It's really good. And hopefully that will help a lot of people.
I appreciate it, guys. I've enjoyed it. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much, mate, for coming in. Don't forget, you can download all of the episodes going back to series one. I don't even know what series this is. What is it, John?
17.
I don't know, it's too many. Too probably many. Probably not going to get funded again. So
you can give us a little follow at Out of Your RL on Twitter. Get your podcast from wherever you can download them from. And we will see you, you little buggers, next week.